Hey, thank you for listening to my podcast. Now, if you're looking for help scaling your e-commerce business or advertising campaigns on Facebook and other platforms, then I want to invite you for a free strategy session. We help entrepreneurs scale from six figures to seven figures and even to eight figures with their e-commerce businesses. So if that's what you're looking for, then I want to invite you. There should be a link somewhere here so you can apply for a free strategy call and we'll see how we can help you out.
Hello guys, Alex Fedotov here. Today we have an amazing guest. We have Vino Jayapalan, and Vino has grown Tabo.co from zero to over $4 million in annual recurring revenue in sales in less than 2 years, with over 1 million meals served to dogs across the country. Vino, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm a huge fan of it. I love listening to especially your students talk about all their tactical Pinterest game tactics. So I'm excited to just chat with you and share our journey.
Thank you. So cool. So if you can tell more about the business, like what do you guys do? What do you guys sell?
Yeah. You know, as you mentioned, Cabo.co is a place where consumers go to find out the best food for their dogs. Really at Cabo, our mission is to help pets live happier and healthier lives. You know, I think with anyone who's entered into a space, you always wonder, you know, how did this guy get to a place where he's selling dog food on the internet? A lot of it really comes from that personal experience of being a pet parent. And one thing that we realized quickly was that when it came to our pets, you know, similar to humans, our health is, you know, very dependent on two things, which is activity and what we eat. So similarly, you know, based on the trends that we struggle with human health, with such things as obesity, these are things that we notice that our pets are facing as well. And when we boiled down into it with activity, what was great was you had companies like Wagon Rover, which made it easy for you to walk your dog, right? Like if you were in home, you can use this app and you get a dog. But when it came down to food, you were still walking to a retail store or going on to Amazon or Chewy and, you know, siphoning through these hundreds of brands where, you know, a dog is running through a forest and one is on a farm and you're like, wait, what food is right for me? And due to the lack of regulations in the space, there's a lot of marketing messaging, which makes it harder for the consumer to actually figure out what's right for them. And that's really the pain point that we saw and said, you know what, we can make the experience easier for consumers when it comes to deciding what's right for my Bichon versus maybe someone who has a senior Great Dane by simply giving us the information of that dog. And then us presenting, you know, fresh diet options that we can deliver directly to them.
That's interesting. And I'm going through your website, and it's such an intuitive like experience. Like, so first you list the name of your dog, and then the breed, and there's like actually the drop down menu with like all different breeds. It's very intuitive. So you said you guys are using like a lot of data, right? Like a lot of the data to kind of like make decisions and improve the customer experience.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, as you mentioned on our site, you know, one of the first things that like differentiate us, I feel like more than most e-commerce sites, when you're going online, you're clicking shop now and, you know, you're browsing through options. We actually took a reverse approach. We realized that, you know, providing more options, the decision-making should actually be based on the information of the dog. So everything from the breed, weight, age, all these variables, what they allow us to do is actually figure out like what is one, the right number of calories they need to eat. Because, you know, the reason 50% or more pets are obese is because we don't know what's the right portion, right? All the bags of food look the same. There's not as much direction. There's a little like chart on the side of a bag that almost looks like a periodic table of elements. And you're supposed to figure out how much to feed your dog.
How do you do that? Like, I mean, someone on your team does it?
Yeah. So we actually, our first hire was someone with a veterinary animal health science background. So she did a graduate studies in nutrition, companion animal nutrition, which was around, you know, trying to figure out what is the right calories based on maybe a certain product form or a certain stage in the dog. And right now, when you know what people should be doing is you can go to your veterinarian and say, hey, this is my dog. This is the requirements. Like, what should the calories be? And using these variables, they're doing this. But the issue that we found is like even when we got our dog, the last thing you do is go to your vet proactively and say, hey, can you calculate this for me? And I'll pay you $150 for a 15-minute appointment. Instead, people are like, okay, I'm just going to look at this bowl and look at my dog. And if they look sad, I'll give them more food, right? And that's what we knew was the biggest problem. So by making this, you know, what seems like a fun quiz where you're entering this information, we're able to calculate and say, okay, this is a senior dog. They might be a bit overweight. So what is that right calorie consumption that we can provide them? And then presenting them diet forms from, you know, freshly cooked dog food to dry dog food that they can pick between. And Let's say it's a larger dog, you might want to have something that's a little bit more suitable to your lifestyle and maybe more dry dog food. Or if you're really concerned about your dog's health or digestibility, you can choose something that's more suitable to them. And then more importantly, you know, from that experience going forward, we're not just this subscription company that's dropping off food. We really care about that core health aspect. So the moment you actually start the food subscription, you actually get paired with a team of vet health, pet health experts. So these are veterinarians and veterinary technicians who have like 15 years experience working in these hospitals and clinics, who will tell you and say, hey, listen, like you have a pug, you mentioned that they have problems with digestibility. You know, we actually—
Is that like telehealth, like for dogs?
It's technically not telehealth because they don't provide any prescriptions or diagnosis. Our pet health experts, and within the Canadian regulation, what they can do is really advise on, like, you know, how do you do the onboarding transition? And they can answer and help with advice around general questions, right? Like, hey, like I've noticed this with my dog's like bowel movements, or hey, my dog's eating grass. Like, what does that mean? You know, so those kind of things they can start to answer. But as you look at like global regulations, like in the States or even in Europe, veterinary and veterinary tech professionals are starting to expand their offerings via telehealth. So we see that, you know, if Canada kind of does move in that direction, we do now have this team of veterinary experts that can offer this to our clientele. But at the moment, they're really focused on, you know, how do we help you with nutrition? And then how do we actually help coach you around like raising your dog? Because it's not like you're getting a puppy and you're saying, okay, like, let me create an 8-year plan for this a golden retriever, and at ninth year, they're going to get arthritis. So I'm going to start to do swimming exercises at age 4. Like, that's not the way people think, right? And our veterinary team is there so they can look through that data that we collect and say, okay, hey, here's a list of dogs that are 3 years old and are golden retrievers. Maybe we should give them a heads up about this type of condition. And it might just be purely educational, but that value add is important for us, for the community that we're building.
And that's very interesting. Like, so, because you're selling the perishable food, right? Like this thing is like, I mean, if you want it to be fresh and if you want it to be like high quality, right? Like, I mean, obviously it's like less preservatives go into that. The food is like kind of like it cannot be maintained. So how do you manage all of that kind of like in terms of the demand, like predicting the demand and maintaining the kind of the supply chain policy?
Yeah, I'd definitely say our first year, well, that was like really a huge focus of ours, saying like on a smaller scale, even us, even, you know, using us as delivery drivers or as cooks, cooking in our own kitchen, we wanted to figure out and see like, where does this supply chain break in terms of like being able to build a strong contribution margin, right? And what we realized what's been great over the past 10 years is when you take away the dog food aspect of our business, we're really looking at perishable goods without as many preservatives as, you know, commercially produced food, moving from one location to the other. And what's really been great here is that meal kits and, you know, last mile food delivery have actually broken the wave there, right? Like in 1999, I remember pets.com, and like, it was impossible because you couldn't ship a bag of food for cheaper than the actual food cost. And now you can ship, you know, a box for $5 across, you know, a region here for last mile delivery. Wow. And therefore, you know, these unit economics are actually quite key towards the scale of it. It's actually looking at the storage and the last mile aspect. And when we look at like meal kits and how much they've grown, when we look at ready to eat meals in human space and how much have they grown, what they've been able to do is show that there needs to be the supply and infrastructure. And in a way, they've paved that path where now we're able to build on top of it and say, you know, we own these distribution points across Canada so we can reach the, you know, 7 to 8 million plus dogs across the country and make sure that the food has a certain transit time from our measurements to say, you know, when we did those tests, we'd say, okay, like how long can this box last for a day, 2 days, 3 days? And what are those variables? And, you know, it kind of goes back to this data piece where when you have these understanding variables, you then start to see, you know, can we put a fulfillment center here? And how does that cost analysis look in terms of like what it could service, as well as like how much it'll save us and what that means in terms of like the customer's experience?
Wow, that's impressive. And so we mentioned, we had a brief chat before this interview, that you're like literally traveling across the country to have, you know, you establishing like new distribution centers. You guys are opening like new warehouses, like new relationships.
Yeah, over the past year, we've opened up one in the West Coast near Vancouver. We've opened up one in Alberta, Calgary. And we have our main one here in Ontario, where we have a majority of our distribution. So when any e-commerce business starts, I think, and, you know, I started off in the world of e-commerce when I was drop shipping on weekends and evenings before even getting into this world. So distribution is kind of key, and figuring out how you can do it in a way that scales really, really means a lot, right? And I think one thing that we always saw here was that when we started, it's not very much like, okay, I have all this capital to go, you know, rent a warehouse. It's very much, let's find a 3PL, let's negotiate some great rates. But the reality that we knew at a given point was that 3PL wouldn't allow us to scale, right? Especially with, you know, dog food subscription and the amount of care and the touch point that we wanted to own with that customer. This became like a huge part of that business is really owning that piece. So we've spent over the past year kind of moving away from the 3PL, now being able to invest in that development of that distribution centers across the country. And yeah, it was a cold trip out to Calgary, I'd say. It was about like minus 18 degrees Celsius. So
wow. So how much time it took for the business to break even with this model? Because with this model, I know that you might kind of like lose break even or lose money up front, try to acquire a customer, but then it kind of like over time it gets momentum. So how much time it took you to get the business to the positive?
Yeah, actually, when we started selling in July 2019, we kind of gave ourselves a marker and said, okay, by July 2020, we want to hit a certain monthly recurring revenue goal, as well as like drive a positive contribution margin. So like that was important because if we can prove it at a small scale and then understand the assumptions and say, yes, okay, we are going to go to 3PL. It's a cost for a year, but it'll allow us to scale and be able to bring it back in-house and implement it. So our focus around that point was hitting that marker. And luckily we were able to hit it like a month prior and really show that like, okay, here's a month where we've been able to kind of focus on these bets and get them into that place. And now it continues to become that game. Now, when we look at that capital investment, as I said, like we're investing in the fulfillment centers. It's not like you see the return right away in the next day, but you know that on a per cost unit basis, you're really starting to optimize at scale. And when you're looking at perishable goods or the food space, whenever you look at public companies as a good comparable, the margin that they're trying to grow on is typically from volume of production, right? So it becomes a very huge volume game at a later point. And now we're very, very much looking at a point where, you know, maybe we were doing a couple hundred pounds of production a month to now over like 30, 40,000 pounds of production a month. And then seeing the next lever on that gross margin growth happen when we hit like 1.5 to 2x of that volume. And it's almost like this catch-up game where you're able to prove out that validity of, okay, here's that margin contribution target, but as well as, okay, let's start to put in towards a capital investment towards the next few point growth that we need on that margin.
Hey guys, people have been asking me how we scale to multiple six figures or even seven figures per month without getting shut down on Facebook. And we have a very sophisticated solution for this that I want to share with you, but it's just like too valuable to give away for free. So if you guys want this solution, just book a call with one of my team members and we'll show you exactly what it is and how it works. And we'll see if that's a good fit for you and for your business. So just book a call with my team member. We'll share it with you so you can scale your business to multiple six figures or even seven figures per month without getting shut down on Facebook, without having inconsistency and with high profitability. So just book a call with my team and I'll see you there.
What was your experience? I mean, you think all these like terms which are like, you know, pretty like sophisticated, like contribution margin, you know. So you've had some like management consulting experience or like some experience with big corporation?
I'm actually a university dropout, so I don't have a lot of.
Oh, really?
I've never worked in consulting as well, unfortunately. But you know, I give a lot of like what I know from observation. So for me, when I was 20 years old, I had an opportunity to drop out, and in 2012 joined Facebook. And you know, this was very early on. Company wasn't public yet. They didn't have newsfeed ads, right? We were doing social like ads, right? And I think for me, what was interesting is instead of being in college and sitting in class, I'm like sitting in the back of the room of a Dollar Shave Club meeting, watching, you know, how they're literally one of the first direct response advertisers using newsfeed ads. But everyone else is reading, you know, this TechCrunch article of how they sold for $1 billion, right? But I got to see the CPA. I got to see how engineers were building the auction. And it wasn't like I was methodically being like, okay, I'm going to build this company. I think I was just being an annoying 20-year-old kid who was bored instead of being in school, was on a Facebook campus. And over time, you know, what happened was, you know, my co-founder, who's also my identical twin brother, he actually finished his school and he does economics and commerce, very strong finance and analytical background. I eventually convinced him to come join Facebook. And during our tenure there, we focused a lot around direct-to-consumer space and retail. So my brother had the harder job, which was like bring Walmart to a digital era. And then I had an easier job, which was here are these like crazy people putting mattresses in a box or a razor in a box and start to think about, you know, how do we scale these learnings? And at the same time, how do we build products? So I worked on things like worldwide targeting, and I spent time in China bringing on the dropshipping community. It was like just such a vibrant time to learn. And for us, our experience just really became almost like playing as like the secondary fiddle, right? Like we didn't have to take the risk, but I could be in the meeting room. And I remember asking people to go visit their warehouse after the meeting. And they're like, it's in upstate New York. Like, and I would take a Greyhound by myself and go and just be like, holy shit, they're selling razors from here directly to people. And
wow.
And I've got a heavy beard. So for me, I was like in Canada trying to get access to a razor was impossible. So it was amazing just watching it. And then we were naturally inquisitive and asking people and seeing the data and just being able to understand like, this is crazy how Facebook's now made it easy to reach people. Shopify's taking the infrastructure game out. You know, China was helping with this global fulfillment and everything was happening. And while we were at Facebook, we even, that's when we started our own dropshipping private label brand because, you know, we wanted to get our feet wet and Facebook kind of encourages you to do your own thing. And we were eventually over time, we scaled that business to about 5 million, bootstrapped it completely and kind of got that first time founder syndrome out. But, you know, we sold everything from fidget spinners to furniture to pet accessories. And I think it was, you know, we spent a good 5 years observing and then got to really apply this ourselves as well as like, you know, start to see from the venture capital world, like what really made sense in financing consumer business, because there was a lot of ups and down from Casper to Outdoor Voices where they're saying, you know, is this the right space for venture, right? And what we realized was that, you know, when you're looking at these types of consumer businesses, the most important things is like, one, is your audience identifiable online and offline, right? And with search, it's so easy because, you know, you have that driven intent. But if you think about discovery, like, can I look at, you know, your Instagram feed and say, okay, you know, he needs a mattress? Probably not, right? And I think that's the interesting piece, right? Flickr in 2006, like you can go on your friends' accounts, they probably have pictures of their dogs. If you go on TikTok now, they have, you know, videos of their dogs. But it's not like a product manager at Facebook was sitting down and saying, how do we get pet people to put up these photos or share this about themselves, right? And I think that was really, really key in some of the best brands we saw be effective in the consumer space while we were at Facebook or when we were working at these companies. And it was because like the more you are able to identify them throughout their journeys, the more you could talk to them. And that's what really created this like scalable opportunity where your CAC can grow, but like, are you getting better customers, right? And I think that was like a really important thing for a lot of people. And the other thing that we realized as well is that it's important to build trust as a consumer brand. And that really comes from thinking about like, what are the daily rituals that individual has? And you know, as a dog person, I feed my dog 2 times a day. I walk them 2-3 times a day and I pick up their poop like 3 times a day. You know, it's an important aspect to think like, okay, does my product remind them every day of like what I'm doing for them, right? And sometimes I wake up from, you know, sleeping on my great mattress, but I'm not saying 3 years from now, oh, thank God, like I'm really grateful for this brand because I don't have any back pain here. Like, you have to understand that like consumer dynamic of like, where do you see them and how do they interact with you? And those are the two most important things to figure out, are you building value for them? And do you have this opportunity? And that was like the biggest takeaway we had from our experience. But, you know, during the moment, I could tell you, I was just being like an annoying kid asking a million questions that people somewhat tolerate.
Have you copied like any of the, because a lot of the great ideas, they basically kind of like replicated one business, looks at another, like, and, you know, kind of copy some concepts, you know, which is like, you know, in Facebook, trying to replicate what Snapchat did or like TikTok did, you know, it's a constant game of like quickly. Was that the case for you as well, where you've seen like, let's say, other business? I mean, obviously Chewy was like a big, like big transaction, but it's more kind of like more general. You're like more niche specifically into like dog food. Was there like a specific business in the United States that had used like similar model as you did and just like blown up?
Yeah, there's definitely in like the freshly cooked direct to consumer dog space. Like there has been a lot of players both in the States, across the world. Like in the States, notably, there's like Farmer's Dog. They're one of the largest players in the space. Have been around since I believe 2018 or so, but they're primarily focused on only providing freshly cooked food. So they don't offer any dry alternative. When you look at the UK, you have great companies like Butternut Box, similar proposition, very focused on freshly cooked and very focused in that region and market. And I think like that's how a lot of D2C players came out in a certain period of time, right? Like you can come out and say, you know what, I'm a shoe company and I'm going to be offering, you know, this waterproof shoe and that's my value add. Or like, hey, my value add is like, I believe that I'm going to give you, you know, these fruit vegan yogurt snacks and deliver them directly to you. But the bigger moat isn't the product. It's actually the overall experience that they're having with you, right? And I think what we saw when we looked at the dog food brands, it's, you know, before these online players, there were hundreds of them in retail, right? So how do they truly differentiate? And they don't. Everyone is always trying to find, like, what's that next trend? It's almost like when you do media buying and you're like, okay, like, buy through whitelist accounts. And then, you know, you always try and find, like, that next hook of, like, what's that angle? It was very similar in D2C, right? Like, at a certain point, it was like, okay, here, we're a flashy cereal box company. Okay, we're a flashy, like, plant pot company. And really, if you strip it down, you're like, these guys are like drop shippers with private labeling with a little bit of fanciness on top of it, right? And I think that doesn't really build defensibility, right? Like, what builds defensibility is understanding, like, okay, what is my end consumer here? And, like, if I'm here to, like, sell them cereal, I'm actually here to solve them, but, like, what goes into their breakfast every single day and giving them energy for the day. And, you know, D2C companies need to think of it as, like, D2C is an entry point there, right? Really, what you have to think about is, like, how do I build a business where I solve this problem as a whole, which means more product offering, which also means a channel outside of online, right? And I think that's a big, big piece that we saw as a shift to saying, like, okay, you can't just say D2C and make it defensible because you're doing it online and you have one specific product, but that is your way where you build your core community and grow from. And I think, like, that's one of the biggest differences that, like, we take and apply, but there's always a lot of learnings that we take, not as much from the dog space, but a lot from the human space. Like, we look at the human side and say, there is a lot of opportunity when you look at how, like, meal kits have focused more on the right type of consumer or ready to eat meals. I think those are the areas we look at and say, you know, as humans start to humanize their pets more, my dad, who, you know, grew up in a village in Sri Lanka, now has a bed for my dog when he visits and a Canada Goose jacket. You know, I don't even think I've ever gotten a good gift like that from him. But, you know, that humanization is something that, like, we want to tap into. And things like our vet tech and vet pet health expert service is that, you know, key focus around people are getting the subscription fatigue. You know, D2C isn't just a defensible model, and one product isn't going to solve it. They're really looking for somewhere where they can address everything.
It seems like you kind of, like, take a little bit from every business, right? And then you kind of, like, put it together, right? So you take some from D2C guys, you take some from, like, bigger corporations, and then you kind of, like, envision your own path.
Yeah, exactly. I think the idea is, like, you just have to start listening to your consumer one step at a time. And I'll tell you, in the beginning, it wasn't like, okay, we're going to do, like, bring in these pet health experts and do all this and dry food. It was literally, we just started with one SKU. We had, like, I think we had our beef recipe SKU. And in the pet world, it's known to have a lot of protein sources because of dog allergies and selections. But we said, you know what, let's do this one SKU for a year. And let's hit the target. Let's show that we can make it work. And then we start to, you know, like, validate that it's worth it to do more. And, you know, as much as I'm into entrepreneurship, there is a bit of risk aversion at a time, right? Like, to take on some SKUs and not know it's going to work. But if we literally have the world's shittiest packaging, one SKU, and people are coming back, then we know we have something and we can go deeper and deeper. And the more you talk to them, the more opportunities you have to test these things, right? Like, we just said, hey, does it make sense to build customer experience team with more animal health science background so that they can provide more value to the consumer and see how it works? And, you know, it started off as, like, an initial contract engagement with a veterinarian that's a huge supporter of ours. And over time, it proved its value and it becomes a core offering of the business, and it continually adds to that end vision that we have.
What is, like, in terms of, like, Facebook, like, acquisition channel, like, Facebook is your main channel right now, or are you other channels working better for you?
Yeah, I'd say, like, on the discovery side, the Facebook ecosystem, which includes Instagram, the networks, I would say as well on the discovery side, what's huge is, like, definitely on the Pinterest and as well as on TikTok side. You know, as always noted, you know, Pinterest audience isn't as huge, or maybe TikTok's ad platforms aren't as well developed. But I'll tell you, like, 2012 Facebook reminds me so much of where TikTok is right now. And, like, Dollar Shave Club, I always say this, like, they were there at the right place and right time and took such a great opportunity of a giant auction where a lot of people weren't playing in. And now advertisers are a lot more sophisticated, but I believe, like, TikTok is going to be that place. I believe, you know, Snapchat, as the audience matures, is going to be that place, and Pinterest. But the reality is most of that discovery budget still is, like, on an 80-20 basis on the Facebook ecosystem. On the intent side is definitely on search with Google, of course, with some spread towards other search platforms like Bing. But search is such a big place for us because the moment you're thinking about a dog, like, you know, maybe you're searching for, like, hypoallergenic dogs, for apartments in Miami, right? And you're looking for a dog that might be suitable, maybe one that doesn't bark. Like, you literally are indicating to us like the moment before you're getting a dog. And our goal should be, you know, how do we touch you at that initial point of making that decision and support you through that? So that when it comes to that food decision, you know, whether you're going to a breeder or a rescue or a veterinarian, we have influence through there. We have the influence through the search channels. And that really helps us build a longer term sustainable top of funnel strategy to bring them in and constantly create efficiency on the discovery platforms.
For the retention, like, can you share some of the hacks that work for you? Like, let's say maybe like to reduce like the churn, because like the difference for like with between like, let's say someone staying with your brand for like 6 months and let's say 8 months could be a massive difference like in your bottom line. So can you share some of the hacks, maybe some of the things you've learned like last 2 years that help you to on that side and their retention?
Yeah, I think the number one thing I always take away from the retention side is that we start everything with talking to the customer first and in the most unscalable ways. And I think like one of the most unscalable things that we did around retention in the beginning was literally me calling every first box customer. And it was, you know, us calling the first box customer and like, we'd look up the information, look up the dog, you know, see the dog's information, you know, see any breed specific information or context that we need to play in there, see why they chose the diets, and then have that conversation. And what we started realizing, like, you know, the touch points of conversion of a decision, like, you know, food, even though it's not you eating that food, it's someone they consider as like a family member, right? It's their furry family baby. So imagine trying to give your, you know, imagine going online and buying D2C toddler food and being like, okay, here it goes to my baby and that's it. So what we realized on retention was really important is like that investment in a higher touch point that might not be as scalable was very important, right? And over time, we've been able to scale that through our pet health expert team. But I think one of those things that was a huge driver was just really being able to create that connection. And when we talked to consumers after, you know, going through an experience like that, what they were able to share as feedback was that, you know, I go online and I'm searching this food, or I heard it from someone, like, this is great. Okay, I buy it, or I read the value prop on the ad. I'm like, this is cool. Okay, let me get this. And then let's say a few days go by or a week goes by, they finally get the product, even though the instructions and everything might be there. Humans are humans, and they're like, holy shit, like, what do I do? This is like totally different from what I used to do before.
I see.
And it's that
the educational aspect of it.
Exactly. And it's like, you know, you could be telling them the exact same thing that's on a sheet of paper in that box, but what's important is that you give them that opportunity, right? And what we started realizing is like, okay, you know, humans now know how to scan QR codes thanks to the pandemic. You know, can we add a QR code? And, you know, we have a video of, for instance, our veterinarian talking about like, okay, how to store your product, how to do this. And so those are the investments that we see as like huge value adds and retention, because you're really trying to win them over in the beginning. The other aspect we look at is like, you know, a dog lives 8 to 15 years. Like, we shouldn't forget about that customer. So one thing that we've been, you know, focused on financing is saying, you know, we want to raise capital so we can invest in value add products for later down the cycle. So with that, you know, one thing, you know, we look at is like, what else can we offer? And we've done, you know, functional product solutions such as like a to-go dog food snack bar. So if you've ever had like a Clif Bar or RX Bar, we did the exact same thing, a protein bar for dogs. So when you're on a hike or a longer walk, you can have this with your dog, and it doesn't dehydrate them like dry food does. And it's more suitable. It doesn't get your pockets all messy. So it's very much designed towards that user experience. And you know, we'll do even fun, non-functional snacks. Like every July, it's National Ice Cream Month. So we have an ice cream that our scientist formulates for dogs. And it's not like required for their health purposes. You know, you don't need ice cream to survive, but it's something fun you can enjoy. And what we realize is like, this is what drives that retention, right? Not only retention, but that organic marketing is that, you know, you can go every July to our Cabo account and you'll see tons of dogs sharing their ice cream experience online without us even asking, right? And the reason that that's important in retention is because you're building a community, you're showing them value. And yes, consumers are purchasing these products, but the reason that they're doing it is because they see that value. And like, that is just as important as that like initial retention effort that you're looking to put on.
Wow, man, so many great insights. I know you're a busy man. So yeah, man, thank you for joining me. Thank you for sharing. I think that insight alone, like with just like having that like educational aspect and like human aspect interaction, like connecting with your like customers one-on-one, and this like, you know, world where it's like everything could be automated, right? Like, the, you know, to some degree, right? Like, but like not many companies do that. And like, and so, and that because of that, like, you don't have much competition, right? Like, you know, who does that really? Like, who calls you? Like, which company actually calls you to help yeah. you, like, see if you're actually using the product?
So, yeah, exactly. I think that human touch point is what people are probably missing a bit more recently, but I think it's always important when you're really trying to drive like that trust within that consumer for your product and your brand.
For sure. What is the potential like for like, I mean, from kind of like estimating the market, like you see like nine figure potential in Canadian market for this type of like product with more like product, like with more SKUs, with more things you can serve your customers with?
Oh yeah, definitely. I think we're on the road to become $100 million business and nothing less of it. I think when my brother and I, you know, first, you know, chose even to build his business, one thing that was important to us is we wanted to build a Canadian business. Like we came to this country as refugees. We got a lot of opportunity from being able to build our career here. And when we even looked at it, what's so interesting about the pet space in Canada is like, if you look at like China's like top three or four or five dog food brands that they import in, like two of them are Canadian brands, right? And you know, if you look at like the top 15 exporters of dog food, like they're coming from Canada. So we have a great agriculture infrastructure, everything to truly build like not only a large domestic business, but one that actually has a great export potential. So we're going for that road or bust. And I think it's going to be a great journey to just be able to work with this many dogs. I think a lot of your customers probably deal with different types of consumers. For us, I got to say, if anyone's out there trying to figure out what to do, animals and pets are the best. They're a lot of fun.
Zesty Paws, right? Like it was Zesty Paws, $610 million acquisition, great business, you know, helping so many dogs with supplements. Is that something also like down the line, supplements for dogs?
Oh yeah, definitely. Like in the coming year, a lot of our investment is towards R&D and innovation. So we have a dental product coming out for dogs. We have health supplements for senior dogs. So those are definitely like things that we're focused on because as you said, like we have this data and we have the age of which the dog signed up and how much older they're getting. And the moment they become a senior dog, or before they get it, we can kind of educate them into the needs of like why this supplement is better than something else. Or, hey, listen, like you have a breed that, you know, has bad teeth and, you know, you should take care of the dental stuff. And here's a solution that we can provide around it.
Man, that's wow. It's very, very inspiring, you know, like what you have done. And I'm excited to see, you know, and observe your path moving forward, like where you take this. But it's an incredible journey. So thank you for sharing it.
Oh, of course. Thanks, Alex, for having me on here.
Cool. Thank you, Winner. Thank you, everyone, guys. We'll drop your like contact details, like your LinkedIn, so many people can connect with you, and also the name of the brand, so you can check it out. If you're in Canada, give these guys a try. And yeah, thank you. Thank you for joining me today,
Alex. Thanks for having me on, Alex. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Winner.
I want to connect, mastermind, and network with 6, 7, 8-figure entrepreneurs. Join our free community on Facebook, which is called Brand Hypergrowth. It's for only entrepreneurs who are already doing at least $30,000 or more in sales per month and want to go to 7, 8 figures. So you can connect, you can network, you can mastermind, you can exchange insights and value with these guys and take your business to the next level. So there should be a link in the description. Make sure you join today.
Hey, thank you for listening to my podcast. Now, if you're looking for help scaling your e-commerce business or advertising campaigns on Facebook and other platforms, then I want to invite you for a free strategy session. We help entrepreneurs scale from 6 figures to 7 figures and even to 8 figures with their e-commerce businesses. So if that's what you're looking for, then I want to invite you. There should be a link somewhere here so you can apply for a free strategy call and we'll see how we can help you out.